Ladies and gentlemen, 7 o'clock on a Saturday night, and that means it's time for the other podcast. I'm your host, Robert Stacy McCain.
And I'm not. Hi, folks. It's the other guy on the other podcast, John Hogue, on microphone number 2 here. Actually, I'm on mic 1. I've got you on mic 2 tonight.
Oh, okay. Anyways, you can find my good friend John Hogue's blogging at HogueWash.com.
And you can find Stacy's excellent scribbling at 2 or 3 places about the internet. Most likely you'll find him at theothermccain.com, but you'll also find him lurking at places like spectator.org.
Yes. And right now, even as we speak, police in Washington, D.C. are trying to stop a riot in progress. Today, they had the Million MAGA March, also known as hashtag Stop the Steal, a giant rally of Trump supporters in downtown Washington, D.C. And the numbers, if you saw some of the video of this rally, it was just this huge turnout.
Meanwhile, it's actually fairly calm and quiet out here at this undisclosed location. How are things in Valdosta?
Tonight, pretty quiet. We have our usual unfortunate call-outs of ambulances. We have a great many elderly people here. But generally speaking, it's been a nice, quiet day.
Yeah, anyways, but the problem with the Million MAGA March downtown is that they stayed past dark in D.C., and that once it got dark, the BLM / Antifa mob went on the attack, and people were beaten, stomped, robbed. It was a very ugly scene. People were throwing projectiles, liquids, explosives at Trump supporters downtown, and the riot police had moved in to try to restore order and protect safety down there. So if you're downtown, and I've got some friends downtown at this event, so if you're downtown, get inside a hotel, go to the bar, have a few drinks, be safe.
Well, actually, they're even impinging on the rioters are going after people having supper in restaurants. So, basically,
but Antifa is just an idea, John. Don't you remember? Joe Biden told us that. Now he's the president-elect.
No, uh-huh. He isn't.
Well,
by the way,
actually,
okay, folks.
No, no one legally becomes president-elect until
the Electoral College
meets and certifies their votes. But the other thing that is interesting, though, about that is I was just before we were getting ready to go on, I was trolling around, and it seems that, remember Ukraine?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems that Ukraine is now having a massive push into the breakaway provinces where the Russians have been active, trying to get control of that before the 20th of January.
Huh. Well,
so,
that's
interesting. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out, considering it means the Ukrainians don't think that certain people are honest politicians that stay bought.
Before we go to our, before we go to the agenda for the show, before we went on air, I started looking. You know, I don't know what the Electoral College numbers are right now, but I was shocked to see that according to, you know, the latest count, Joe Biden is the winner in Georgia. Mm-mm. Okay.
No, he's not.
Georgia, the state of Georgia, by a margin of about 14,000 votes.
And, out of most almost 5 million.
Right, right. It was about 4.93 million votes cast in Georgia, and Biden won with a margin of we are told that he won with a margin of 14,172 votes. That's mm-hmm. What is currently out there.
Well,
now,
yes, but
I started looking at this and comparing the 2016 numbers to 2020. In 2016, President Trump got 50.4% of the vote in Georgia, a majority, whereas Hillary Clinton got 45.4%. Trump's margin in 2016 was 211,141 votes. Might as well say 211,000 votes. Okay, so there has been a shift, right, we're told, of about a shift in the margin of about 225,000 votes. How did that happen? Huh. Well, I compared the numbers. And President Trump increased his vote from 4 years ago by about 18%. That is to say, he increased his vote by 369,000 votes, roughly, nearly 370,000 votes. However, Biden's vote was more than 594,000 votes more than what Hillary Clinton got, for a 32% increase in the Democratic vote, nearly a third.
Almost all of it from
that
one county.
Almost, well, nearly no. Half of it from a single county, and that would be Fulton County, Georgia. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that
We should explain that Fulton County is the county that contains Atlanta.
Yes, it does. Atlanta. It contains most of Atlanta. Atlanta is actually spilled over into DeKalb County now because of it's just uncontrolled. But anyways,
I think the actual city limits are essentially the Fulton County line.
All right, then. Well, anyways, keep in mind that Biden's margin, we are told, statewide is about 14,000 votes. He carried Fulton County by 243,904 votes. Nearly 244,000 votes was his margin. Okay, 4 years ago, the Democratic margin, Hillary Clinton versus Trump, was about 180,000 votes. In other words, Biden increased his margin. Okay, and I'm trying to get this right. Biden increased his vote in Fulton County alone compared to 4 years ago with Clinton. Biden's increase was 84,000 votes.
Mm-hmm. Compared to about 19,000 increase for Trump. So
right,
obviously,
right. Trump increased his vote by nearly 17%, over 4 years ago in Fulton County. So you have this inordinate and perhaps inexplicable.
Oh, no, I can explain it quite easily.
Does it involve the word fraud?
Well, let me put it to you like this. Here's another statistic about the votes in Georgia between the two elections. In 2016, 166,000 voters voted for a third party candidate.
Mm-hmm.
This year, 64,000. So where did those 102,000 votes go? There was a bigger turnout, but a smaller percentage of the voting third parties. Now, maybe you can say, okay, there's a few thousand people who didn't, you know, who voted for Trump this time because they didn't think they could afford to vote for whoever the Libertarian or whatever it was, but not 102,000, not when the vote increases as much as it did. So yeah. that just flat out doesn't work.
But there are a lot of suspicious, and I single out Atlanta, Georgia here. Because we have seen similar things in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Detroit, Michigan, Philadelphia.
Even Marley's crying about it. If you can hear it,
howling. This is tragic.
We've got a MAGA dog there who is crying because he's afraid that Joe Biden has won.
Well,
in
you know,
city after city.
Well,
you see this cities. Huge vote for, you know, Las Vegas, Nevada. Clark
Every
County.
Single person I know who has been involved in auditing processes.
Oh, Lord, have you
tells me that they're seeing enough stuff in what's going on that they would be opening major audits to try to get this thing.
And they could retire on the fees.
Oh, yeah.
That's the truth.
But the example of this is just, if you look at data, mm-hmm. data in the real world follows certain statistical patterns, unless you have something that binds it in a particular way. Like if you have a particular list of checks that all came out of the same part of the checkbook, they may all start with the same, you know, digit because you know, mm-hmm. you got like a 4-digit number and you're in the 1400s. So they all start with a one. Okay. But in random variables, there are patterns that are just a part of nature. And
one of those patterns
has to do with called Benford's Law.
Benford's Law. Okay. Now Benford's Law has to do with where various digits occur in random samples, and it has been used
thereof.
What?
The distribution of digits in a random sample.
Right. And it has been used in accounting as a means of detecting fraudulent bookkeeping because people will enter fake numbers in a non-random pattern. It has also been used to detect vote fraud, where false tallies in precincts will follow the same principle.
Yeah, once again, it only applies in truly random situations. For example, if you look at pricing at a dollar store, it will work.
Yeah, no. But anyways, but an article talking about that Benford's Law has proven that cheating occurred in urban areas that went heavily for Joe Biden. Now, this article, you know, I can't vouch for it, right? Okay, in other words, I don't know enough about this principle. I don't know enough about the votes. I don't know.
I can.
Okay, well.
I had to pass. I made an A in that course.
All right.
Yay,
well, anyways, but if you tried to post that this past week on Facebook, okay, it's being censored. Okay.
It's also being censored on Twitter. Our friend Peter Ngami has been shut down 3 times now for posting.
Yeah. Evan Sayet got booted off of Twitter this past week. People are getting booted left and right for trying to talk about
a basic principle of mathematics and statistics.
Yes. Right. You cannot cite this because to do so is apparently something like that. And
well, no, actually, the excuse that Twitter is using is that you have posted intimate information or pictures of someone without permission. And I can tell you right now, I've looked at Pete's post, and they're not even images of human beings, let alone porn.
Yes.
I performed my own experiment. I found a mathematics video from YouTube about Benford's Law. And while I do find the presenter extremely annoying, he actually did a pretty good presentation, so I linked it. Nope, not allowed. I tried another one. Nope, not allowed. Basically, and that's just, it's wrong to do that to people. Benford, you can't, it, most people are going to look at this and their eyes are going to glaze over. Let's be really honest, understanding the math behind the statistic, why statistics do these things, is really hard. So you need a nice, clever presentation to help you understand it. And I mean, I'm not even going to say, I didn't say anything about fraud. I said, oh, I've heard that Benford's law is being discussed. Here are a couple of videos. Nope, not allowed even to do that.
Yeah, and the thing is that there are, there are precedents here. I linked to a column by Byron York, who points out that 4 years ago, after the 2016 election, Democrats, pressed their, and I'm quoting here, pressed the cheating accusation to extraordinary lengths month after month, year after year, claiming that Trump had stolen election, right? Okay. And here it goes. The claim that Trump won in 2016 by conspiring with Russia, okay, on January 6th, 2017, 2 weeks before Trump was inaugurated, Congress met in joint session to certify the results of the Electoral College. It had historically been a ceremonial pro forma event, but several House Democrats in 2017 tried to block certification of various state results. Representative Barbara Lee objected to certification, quote, on behalf of the millions of Americans, including members of the intelligence community, who are horrified by evidence that the Russians interfered in our election, end quote. Okay.
Note at this point, the intelligence community knew that the whole thing was bogus and was something stirred up by the Clinton campaign.
Right, right. And I have talked about this before, is that every 4 years, since 2000, right, Democrats have talked about voter suppression, right?
Well, not in 08 or 12.
Yeah, when they win, but they're always claiming that Republicans are somehow suppressing votes.
Yeah.
Okay. And
But when you win an election, you've clearly suppressed the good guys, mm-hmm. right? Isn't the way it works? This whole thing, though, they're so brazen with it this year. I'm at the point where I got fed up with Facebook. Now, look, I didn't get on Facebook because I wanted to. I got on Facebook because my aunts nagged me about being able to share family pictures. Mm-hmm. And my last surviving aunt died like 2.5 years ago. And so it dawned on me this week, why am I still on Facebook? So Friday, I hit the delete button. And that's it. I'm gone from Facebook, and I'm still on social media. You can find me on Gab, where I'm a minor shareholder, by the way, or you can find me on Parlay, or you can find me on MeWe, and I'm still on Twitter, at least for a while. So, but the point is, I've had enough of this
high-tech censorship.
Yeah, but particularly so far, because I beat Twitter once when they permanently banned me, and then they wound up having to let me back on. I'm sticking there just to keep my thumb in their eye. Mm-hmm. But other than that, these people are just the enemies of happiness.
Yeah, I had a post this week in which I showed, Andy Ngo. If you know who Andy Ngo is, he is a reporter who has extensively covered Antifa. And he posts mugshots of the rioters being arrested. Okay, and he put up a set from Portland, Oregon, showing four people. I think they're all women, but I don't want to misgender anybody. But he put up a picture of those, and I linked that to something that our friend at Instapundit, Professor Glenn Reynolds, said, quote, "My daughter has already noticed that the folks in her circle who are most into activism of various sorts are mostly the ones whose careers and lives seem to be going the worst." Mm. And this is not a coincidence, of course. Political activism, as promoted by the left, is entirely destructive in its goals. It's an internal war against an unacceptable status quo. And so this naturally appears to malcontents and misfits. So in other words, the problem is that these protesters aren't unhappy and crying in their mugshots. They don't look so miserable, right? Mm-hmm. Because they got arrested. They got arrested because they're so miserable. And
well, looking at these four, at least two of them have a drug habit, probably some sort of speed.
One of them definitely looks like a meth head. The one with
she does.
One of them needs to meet up with a tube of Clearasil.
Well, you know, these are not
healthy people.
They're not healthy.
Stacey, I keep telling you we need to have another conversation about Rule 5.
Yeah. But here's the thing is that, you know, when I got into journalism, okay, I didn't get into journalism because I wanted to change the world, you know, to make a difference, as they say. I was just looking for I just needed a job, okay? And I was covering, you know, local news and stuff like that down in Georgia. And it wasn't this you know, crusading kind of social justice nonsense. And so, but I never wanted to be an axe grinder, okay? And that's what I think of when I think of these activists, you know, that they're always somebody that they've got some grievance, okay? I have no grievance. I'm generally a happy person. I'm sitting here in my dining room table, you know, and I recalled in my post this week, I said that I remember, right, when I first moved to Calhoun, Georgia to take a job as a newspaper sports editor, I could pack all my worldly possessions in the back of my 1984 Chevette. Okay. And so I've now got a little bit, let's just put it to you this way. I've got a lot more than would fit in the back of a Chevette if I still had the Chevette, but you know, I blew a gasket back in the day. And so it,
yeah, well, that was not the high point of General Motors technology.
Yeah.
The mention of a Chevette reminds me of another vehicle of the same vintage that actually I think shared the same engine later as an improvement. But there was an ad in the Thousand Oaks News Chronicle when I lived there that said, "For sale, four Goodyear A78 by 13 black wall tubeless tires, $200, includes a 74 Vega."
No, the Vega was earlier. But,
yes, I know, but it was you know, the Chevette. But if you think about the Chevette, is the upgrade to that. It's you know, that's where we are. But you know, you have an accomplishment,
right?
You have some accomplishments in your life, and that's what these activists, for the most part, don't have.
Right?
They've never done anything, and so. And their response is to, well, maybe we can undo something.
Right. It's like, One of my things is that I have often remarked that I'm basically a selfish person, okay? Because taking care of me is a full-time job, okay?
Wife has mentioned that. Yeah.
But in other words, what I'm trying to say is that keeping my own act together, okay, requires so much of my, the idea of bossing around other people, you know. I mean, I've been here with a couple of my grandchildren. Just keeping an eye on a couple of my grandchildren is enough to overwhelm me. So I don't have the emotional or intellectual energy.
Those two may be the only people I've ever seen that might be able to out-crazy you.
Yeah. Well, but the point being that who are these people that have their lives so together, right, that they can tell the rest of us how to live our lives?
Well, that's just it. They don't. And that's why they're angry, particularly when they see somebody who has an accomplishment.
Right.
Is simply happy.
Right.
I mean, there's nothing that makes them more furious than some middle class person who's perfectly happy in their life and perfectly satisfied with their life.
Or somebody who maybe had a good head start on the situation, but actually has done something in his life.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And one of the people that really drives them up the wall is Donald Trump. A man with some
accomplishments. Really, you say?
Yeah, I say. But you know what? A man with some accomplishments. And you know what I think his greatest accomplishment is? Ben Weingarten.
Living rent-free in their heads?
Well, Ben Weingarten had a post that I very much agree with, and I kind of spun off from. Mm. He says that Trump's greatest accomplishment is exposing the rot and corruption that has pervaded the elites in the American system. You know, Trump's predecessors, Truman on the bureaucracy, or Eisenhower talking about the military-industrial complex, or Nixon, who you remember was the first one to start talking about the corrupt media, scratched the surfaces on the kinds of challenges that Trump has dealt with. But it's Trump who's like ripped the bandage off the wound, and you can see where the scab has come off. And you know, that's really, judges are important. Regulation is dialing that back is important. Peace in the Middle East is important, but exposing the rot is really the biggest thing that he's done. It's the reason why, even if the election goes to Biden, you're going to see that what Trump has got going isn't going to go away. But that reminded me of a book that I read 4 or 5 years ago called Coming Apart by Charles Murray.
Yes.
And Murray points out in his book that what happened is our betters in society have basically turned away from virtues like marriage or industriousness or religiosity or even honesty. But they've done on, at least publicly, but they've held on to most of those values themselves. College-educated people are still significantly more likely to marry and stay married and raise their children inside of intact families than the population as a whole. They work hard, but usually that's administrating or enacting the welfare state or something related to it. They tend to be very religious, but usually not in one of the traditional religions, usually on one of the Marxist or neo-Marxist replacements. But they've given up, but because of their Marxism or neo-Marxism or whatever you want to call it, they've given up on the epistemological basis of understanding what the meaning of what the meaning of is basically. And so truth is malleable for them. So how can you be honest when there's no such thing as truth? And, Trump pull the bandage off, and now we can see what's going. And the question is, what are we going to do about it? Which then led me to remembering something that Bertolt Brecht wrote back in the 50s when things weren't going so well for the East German government. He has a poem. I won't read it in German because I learned German in Switzerland and my accent's terrible. But the end of the poem translates, "Would it not be in that case simpler for the government to dissolve the people and elect another?"
Yeah. And by the way, Bertolt Brecht was a man of the left.
Okay. Oh, a flaming communist.
Yeah. And so the failure of communism was something that even the left noticed back in the day.
Mm-hmm. And actually, he was one of the first really honest enough to be able to talk about the failure of communism, especially Stalinism. And it would be another almost decade before the French neo-Marxists would get in line with him.
Yeah, well, the thing is that there has been a long history, okay, of left alienating its supporters.
We don't alienate our supporters because we are not Marxists, we're capitalists.
That is true.
And to prove it, I'm going to direct people's attention to any page of the other McCain.com where I see a yellow button.
Speaking of the yellow button, yes, as a matter of fact, I was concerned this morning when I was working on the blog and the yellow button wasn't showing up. If you will go to my blog, theothermccain.com, you will notice near the top of the center column a yellow button with the word donate on it. If you will click the donate button, it will take you to my PayPal account to where you can contribute dollars, pesos, pounds, yen, any currency, wherever you are in the world, you can contribute.
Do you really want yuan and rubles?
I'll take what. Look, folks, if you want to, whatever currency you got, we take it via PayPal. If you'll click the yellow button, and you can contribute to the support of the blog, and also to help support the podcast.
Yes.
Meanwhile, over at my good friend John Hoag's blog, Hoagwash.com.
You can look in the sidebar out there on the right and you'll see the icon of a tip jar. Click on it and you're taken away to my PayPal account where you can donate to support the blog. Or you can shop at the Hoagwash store. Click on the icon of the hat and it will take you down to Cafe Press and the Hoagwash store page where you can spend all sorts of money on, well, let's just say interesting stuff branded in ways related to the blog. Or you can shop the Amazon links that you'll find at Hoagwash or the other McCain or actually other bloggers. Those of us who are members of the Amazon Associates operation are have these links on our blogs. And when you shop there, the blogger actually receives a small commission on the transactions. That's another way of supporting bloggers. But the really important thing is the yellow button. So that brings us to the five most important words in the English language,
which are hit the freaking tip jar.
Yes, please.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
On the other hand, look, Stacy, I don't know about you, but I actually look at my comments and I blog as a hobby. So I blog about stuff that interests me. And if nobody is interested in that blog post, but I am interested in keeping my readers at least interested enough that they hang around. I think you have the same sort of point of view.
Right, right. The idea is that as a writer, okay, you have to think about your readership. Okay. Mm-hmm. If you're not thinking about, if if you don't think about what does this mean to my readers,
okay? Or are you, if you, or
who
are you,
is my readership?
Well,
who
the
are
other,
these people?
Well, the other thing that's important is, assuming that you're doing this as a business, it's a really dumb business decision to piss off your readership.
Yes, it is.
Or your viewership.
Or your viewership. Speaking of the network formerly known as Fox News, people have begun to call it faux news. Conservatives are sick and tired of this. And by the way,
the last time I saw a ratings collapse like this was actually there's a radio station in D.C. called WETA. And WETA-TV is the television operation that produces things like what used to be called the McNeil Air Report. I guess it's called the PBS NewsHour now. But their local FM station used to be a wonderful, mostly classical music station, but you know, the sort of thing that had all the goodies from NPR and American Public Radio and that sort of stuff, and they went all news.
Yeah.
And their readership, their listenership went down from like a 2, which is 2% of a large metro area is a significant rating, to like 0.2. they went from one of the top rated FM stations in the market to the bottom of the market. At the same time, the other NPR station in the market doubled its listenership. So, and funniest thing, they got their listeners back when they went back to classical music.
Yeah,
it helps to actually serve your customers.
Yeah, you have to think about who the audience is, and Fox News exists, okay, because a guy named Roger Ailes had a brilliant idea of trying to do something of TV.
We report, you decide.
Right. It was TV, and the idea was to do it free of liberal bias. What would TV news look like without liberal bias? And that was the idea of Fox. And of course, it attracted a largely Republican audience. Now, let me say this, is that I when I went to work for the Washington Times in 1997, I understood I was working for a conservative paper, okay? Washington has the Washington Post, one of the biggest and most influential liberal papers in
yeah, I guess
the
Star was gone at that time by then.
What?
The Star, the old...
Right. Okay, so in order for Washington to be a two newspaper town, there had to be some rationale for the second newspaper, and to try to counterbalance the liberalism of the Post, okay, was our raison d'etre, right? It was our reason for existence. If it had not been for that, right? Okay. If people wanted to read liberal bullshit, excuse my French, they could read the Washington Post. So we were the other paper. I understood the mission. Okay. And it was hard to get some of our staffers, particularly the young staffers on the Capitol Hill Bureau, some of them didn't quite understand this. And as an assistant editor on the national desk, I found myself constantly fighting the Capitol Hill Bureau that where what they wanted to write for is, instead of writing for our readership, They were concerned about how their peers in the Capitol Hill press corps would perceive them. In other words, they were thinking of their own future careers, perhaps after working for the Washington Times. And so they were selling the same narrative, right? They were trying to essentially match what you were reading in the Washington Post, the Associated Press, New York Times, everybody else. And I used to have to explain to him, I said, no, you know, budget battles, right? Budget battles. Okay. No, a tax cut does not cost money. Okay. Because that's how it's framed in the rhetoric on Capitol Hill. How much will the tax cut cost? No. Cutting taxes does not cost money. Okay, you're looking at it from the government point of view. We look at it from the taxpayer point of view. Okay, that's what I was trying to get across to them. And this, but this idea of set asides, I think, what did they call it?
Earmarks.
Yeah, but the idea of that a tax cut was going to cost, quote unquote, the government money. And I'm like, it's not the government's money. You know, and I hate to sound like an Ayn Rand fanatic here, but it come down to basic truth. And so I found myself arguing with this. And this week, since election night, Fox News famously called Arizona very early before it could call Texas, Florida, or Ohio. Now,
they didn't call Alaska till this week.
Right. Okay. And so you linked another post in our memo, but the one that got, speaking of readers, in a single day, I got about 8,000 hits on this post with the headline, "Chris, we haven't called Texas yet." And it's got it. And if you can find this on my the other McKay, "Chris, we haven't called Texas yet." Okay. And it's got a picture of Chris Steierwald, and they're showing him next to where they have checked Arizona for Biden's column. And Brett Baier, Brett Baier is one of the good guys. I know Ace has been just so anti-Fox entirely that he wants to put them all into a bucket and dump them in the ocean. But
we'll get to Tucker Carlson in a minute.
Okay, but Brett Baier was on there. And so after they called Arizona, they bring on Chris Steierwald as the representative of the Fox News decision desk. And if you know who Chris Steierwald is, he's a somewhat endomorphic fellow. I'm being kind, okay? I'm trying to be kind here. And so Brett Baier is trying to point out, he says, we haven't called Texas yet. Okay. He said, why haven't we called Ohio? Okay. And Steierwald just stares into the camera and goes, Ohio is close. Obviously, we see the president has an advantage, and he's had an advantage in polling in Ohio the same way he has in Iowa for the closing stretch of the election. I would point out pre-election polls in this cycle have so far turned out to be really, really good, close quote. What? And I read that, and if you can see the video of this, it's insane. It's absolutely insane, right? That, in other words, he's saying that the polls are what they're using to make these calls. Okay, so meanwhile, the Real Clear Politics average of Ohio polls was 7 points off. 7 points. That's outside the margin of error, because they included in there such things as the Quinnipiac poll. Quinnipiac poll had Ohio plus had Biden winning by 4 points, a 12-point error. Okay, Trump won Ohio, and I told you guys all along, Trump won Ohio by 8 points. It was never really close, but they had not called Ohio at this point. Okay,
well, I mean, you could look at the map of Ohio and see. I mean, you know, okay, there's a swath up by the lake near Cleveland, and you know, Cincinnati and Columbus and a few places like that, and you know, then just red.
Yeah, and but meanwhile, and toward the end of the conversation, Brett Baier says to Steierwald, "But Chris, We haven't called Texas yet. Why haven't we called Texas? Starwalt's answer was, because it's too close to call. Okay, now keep in mind, let me hang on just a second. Okay, just hang on a second. I've got to see. But at this point, I think the margin in Arizona is less than 20,000.
Yeah.
Okay. The margin is less than 20,000. Trump won Texas by more than 650,000 votes.
Mm-hmm.
More than 650,000 votes.
You think he could ship a few to Georgia?
Yeah, but Chris Steigerwald said it was too close to call. Oh, but they could call Arizona where the final margin is razor thin. But oh, you can't call Texas. Texas, Steigerwald.
Well, Texas was supposed to go purple.
Yeah, anyway.
And then, you know, it's like, and they flipped how many Republican seats?
Oh, it's crazy.
None.
Yeah. So far, the net gain for Republicans in House seats, because apparently when they're harvesting ballots, which is what they've been doing, when they were harvesting ballots, all they cared about was the presidential vote. And so apparently you have thousands upon thousands of ballots that did not vote for anything else except president.
And they all seem to be for Biden.
Right. And all of these mysterious ballots that come in late by mail, you know, some of them from dead people. But all of these extra ballots.
I've been assured that my late father-in-law only voted twice.
Right. Well, anyways, but the point being that Democrats have had a net loss of at least 9 seats so far.
Yeah, and here's what's also interesting. On all the close bellwether, you know, close in scare quotes, bellwether races in the House, mm-hmm. Republicans are 100%.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The Democrats didn't win a single one of the, you know, stuff that was just, you know, name brand theirs.
Yeah, they lost the two biggest swing states of all, the ultimate bellwether states, Ohio and Florida, both went for Trump.
And it looks like that they flipped one district in Iowa, and it looks like they're retaining another two. So Iowa is going to be a majority Republican things, which means there are 26 states that will have majority Republican House delegations. So if for some reason it does go to the House and the delegations vote by state, it's majority Republican.
Yeah. Well, we will see about
it first.
Yeah. Well,
even that thing is skewing away from the Democrats the same way that, you know, the Republicans flipped governorships, mm-hmm. they flipped control of state legislatures, mm-hmm. you know.
And, yeah, well, anyways, but getting back to Fox and their error, okay, for 8 days, they refused to admit that they had missed on election night about a quarter after 9 Eastern time on election night. The Fox News decision desk can now project that Democrats will retain control of the House and expand their majority by at least 5 seats. For 8 days, that error went uncorrected, unnoticed, and unmentioned by Fox News until Brett Baer finally on Wednesday night, I think that was Wednesday night, Brett Baer, he said that did not occur. that was how he expressed it. He was talking to one of the reporters on air, and he says that they had correctly predicted that Democrats would retain control, but the projection about Democrats adding 5 seats to their majority did not occur.
You know, it's going to be really interesting. McCarthy, who's the Republican majority leader in the House, has pointed out that there are 10 Democrats who voted against Pelosi to be Speaker in 2018 who are coming back. If those same 10 vote against her this time, that means she doesn't have 218 votes, which means she isn't she can't win as Speaker. Now, I don't think that those, unless they change parties or something, I don't think those 10 Democrats would put a Republican in as Speaker. But I'll tell you what they might do is they might have is a boatload of leverage on who the next Speaker is going to be.
Yeah.
Well, so it's going to be interesting right after the first of the year.
Yeah. And, you know.
Meanwhile, the other interesting thing going on at Fox is Tucker Carlson, the only one with any ratings left.
Yeah. Tucker Carlson. You know, and by the way, there are people who are so fed up with what Fox did on election night. And also, let's not forget what Mike Wallace did as the debate moderator.
Chris's son.
What?
Not Mike, Chris.
Chris Wallace.
Mike's son.
Yes, I'm sorry. Chris Wallace did as the debate moderator. But that people are so sick that they're not watching. They won't even watch Tucker Carlson anymore. Mm. People have just pulled the plug and switched over to the Newsmax. But he's stuck at a network that has declared war on its audience, is Tucker Carlson. And I pointed out that what has surprised me most about Carlson is that he's far more paleoconservative than I had any reason to imagine. And
he was like that when he was a young kid on CNN.
But I don't remember that. I remember him as this sort of arrogant fop with this floppy hair and the bow tie, and just a sort of frat boy vibe coming off from him. I didn't like him.
Well, no, but if you listen to what he was saying, he sounded like Bob Novak.
Well, you know, that's the thing is that he and Novak took turns battling Bagala and Carville on CNN back in the day. And Novak was paleoconservative.
Boy, howdy.
Yeah, well, you know, I remember, I very much remember Novak. There was an event in, I want to say it was late 2002 or early 2003. I believe it's probably the fall of 2002. That Pat Buchanan was there. And I forget, one of our columnists from the Washington Times was there, and I can't call her name. I believe she's passed on now. But Bob Novak was there, and he was as against the Iraq War as Buchanan was. And, and the fact that a lot of conservatives of that stripe, never bought into the arguments for the Iraq War was something that, people have forgotten, but the idea that we have something to gain and nothing to lose by what you might call a neo-imperialist policy in the greater Middle East is something, you know, I've sometimes referred to that whole thing as the invasion and occupation of Mesopotamia, because the idea that we're going to, that we're going to control that region when we can't even control Portland. Okay. We can't control Chicago. We can't control Detroit. We've got problems at home. We can't control the southern border.
But one of the accomplishments that does relate to peace in the Middle East is the fact that Donald Trump is the first president since Gerald Ford that hasn't started a war.
Yeah, hadn't started a foreign war. But I talked about the fact that when when they started originally staffing up the Fox News network, they leaned very heavily toward New York Catholics, especially from Long Island Irish Catholics. Mm-hmm. Sean Hannity, Brian Kilmeade, what?
Bill O'Reilly.
Bill O'Reilly, yes. Bill O'Reilly was the typical, it was back in that day when Al D'Amato ran the Long Island machine. It was the Long Island machine was the secret of that. And they had this, and I can't recall his name, this campaign advisor that basically the way to win out in Long Island was to point to the Democrat and say, liberal, liberal, liberal. Apparently, and it was a very simplistic sort of thing. But you've got to understand that this was in the age where New York City, right, where most of these, your Long Island Republicans, right, had actually been born, or their parents at least were from Queens, the Bronx, Brooklyn, and they had just basically been run out of New York proper. And onto Long Island, Nassau County especially, was populated by people whose folks had, you know, grown up in the city, but the city had become unlivable. And this was the age where David Dinkins was the mayor of New York, and we talked about Snake Plissken escape from New York. People have no idea. Young people have no idea how bad New York was 30, 40 years ago.
Well, they can go.
It's getting there. It's going back.
Actually, I think it may be as bad as it ever was now. The 70s and 80s, I had to be in and out of New York on business, and it was
horrible. Had teenage prostitutes on the streets.
You know what? It was the first place I ever paid $2 for a cup of coffee.
Okay.
Back in the 70s.
But anyways, one of the things about these Irish Catholic, a lot of Catholics in general, but these Irish Catholic New Yorkers had this misty-eyed idea of America as a nation of immigrants, because of course their ancestors had been, you know, Ellis Island and that tradition of that. And so this idea,
I'm descended from folks from Scotland and other places in the British Isles, the nation of immigrants. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But the point is, John, and this is true of both of us, is that our ancestors got here before the revolution. We were colonial settlers.
I mean, look at Elizabeth Warren. Her ancestors came across the Bering Strait, apparently.
But the point being is that one of the basic divides that people don't talk about anymore, but it used to be, if you talk to Michael Barone, is that what used to be called the ethnics, right? And this was that the Reagan coalition. What made the difference for the Reagan coalition is that they were able to get the ethnics, the Poles, the Italians, the Irish, that had once upon a time been New Deal liberals right up until 1972 is when it sort of breaks, okay, against. And you start getting these ethnics.
It begins to break in 68.
Right, right, right. But you remember that 1968 was a very close election, okay? And it was really, 1972, that landslide for Nixon, one of the things is that the ethnics, as they were called, had just gotten fed up because what the Democratic Party they joined and supported all their lives was with the AFL-CIO, George Meany, you know, patriotic, red-blooded kind of
blue-collar.
Anti-communist.
I mean, look, what's a poll going to be in favor of, you know?
Right.
You know, not in the 70s or 80s? No.
The polls especially, but also a lot of Jewish Americans.
Same thing. But, you know, what you see, though, is these cities that they have that have these cities that the Democrats have remained in control of or assumed control of, mm-hmm. the Chicagos, the Portlands, the New Yorks, you know, people are now talking about Weimar America.
Right.
And, you know, I had a post this morning called Some Thoughts, and it starts off with saying that, you know, remember that story that came out in the Washington Democracy Dies in Dirt, this post published that false story about the Erie, Pennsylvania postal worker recanting his claim about backdated postmarks. And it turns out that when Project Veritas published the raw audio of his interrogation, mm-hmm. the interrogating agent is a guy named Strasser.
And nobody noticed that?
Strasser.
Well, I commented that neither Captain Renault or any of the usual suspects were available for comment. I have a picture of Conrad Veidt as part of the post. And for those of you who have seen the movie, you will recognize him in his nice Luftwaffe uniform. Following on a mid-20th century sort of line of thought, though, Dart Serber had a post this morning suggesting that we shouldn't blow off AOC. He was writing, let's not blow off Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez. You may not see her appeal, but millions of Democrats do. She's the soul of the soulless Democratic Party. AOC's danger is unlike Obama, Manchin, and the rest of the 50 or and older crowd in the Democratic Party. She does not seek power. She seeks revolution. You know,
I'm sorry, she's the modern Ruth Fisher. She's shrill. She's the only difference is that she stands up straight, well, wears clothes well. You could never accuse Ruth Fisher of that.
Well,
and
I mean,
she's sort of pretty.
Well, I mean, she, you know, I look at the magazine shots that she does, and I think she could have a wonderful career as the kind of model that models clothes in the Orvis catalog. You know, she certainly doesn't know how to walk the same way that the First Lady does. But anyway, but I understand I understand what she's selling and the appeal she has to the younger cohorts of socialists. And it's this, when we had Obama as president, we were fundamentally changing America, but then the old men and women in the party let Orange Man Bad win. We were stabbed in the back.
Yep.
Now you may not want to buy what she's selling, but there's historical precedent that sales pitch works, particularly when you tie it to something that appeals to racial superiority, and that's where the rest of the squad comes in. Server's post goes on to quote Rashida Tlaib as saying, "We're not interested in unity that asks people to sacrifice their freedom and their rights any longer. And if we truly want to unify our country, we have to really respect every single voice. We say that so willingly when we talk about Trump supporters, but we also say that willingly for my black and brown neighbors and from LGBT neighbors or marginalized people." And then Serber adds, "Take her seriously. She's playing with racist fire." And the problem is that they're not the Democrats' worst nightmare. They're what the Democrats are starting to believe. And they're America's worst nightmare. You know, I'll be 73 on New Year's Eve. And over the course of my life, I've watched America, for the most part, move away from that ugliness that's racism and racial superiority? Well, most of America, but not all, because it seems like there's a part of the Democratic Party that still is holding on to the idea of racial superiority. They've just switched to which side they're on. And I really don't think we need a redo of the 20s and 30s of Europe here in America.
Yeah, and one of the things, and I forget who it was, but someone said that if you didn't like Jim Crow, just wait until you get Crow Jim, okay? That in other words, that it's exact, and see if you understand anything about how political rhetoric works. Okay.
You're a far right extremist.
Yeah, right.
I'm going to get to that.
You're a far right extremist.
Hang on. How political rhetoric works. Okay. How do you move the Overton window? Okay. In other words, if you're trying to shift something, it is not enough to deny your opponent's claim. What you want to do is to assert the exact opposite. Right. Okay. Well, if the other guy is saying we need more police to stop crime, okay,
you're a far right extremist. We're going to move the window to where that's just something we can't talk about.
You're just upset because we're running over our appointed hour.
No, actually, we're only 6 minutes over, and we can go 2 hours over if we want to.
Well, anyway, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. Anyone concerned about the integrity of the 2020 election is part of a, quote, cluster of far-right extremists, including neo-fascist, white nationalists, and militia members, end
and this
quote.
This is exactly
can
what
we
you're
find
going
some
up.
Some of those? Can we find and interview some of the above? I mean, sorry.
Well, I actually know some of them by personally.
But the point is what they're trying to do is move where the window is. And now what we're talking about is just beyond the pale of decent conversation.
Right. And by the way, the far right extremists include such people as Michelle Malkin, Jack Posobiec, Mike Cernovich, Amy Kramer, and in other words, a lot of people that are certainly not goose stepping neo-Nazi Jew haters.
It includes me. Just try to link to a Hogwash post on Facebook. Okay. I'm Hogwash. My website is considered offensive by Facebook.
Well,
that's
anyways,
one of the reasons why
everyone involved in the march in downtown D.C. today was supposedly part of this far right. And they love to use the thing far. You're a far right extremist. Well, Michelle Malkin, right?
Okay. No, she isn't.
Michelle Malkin is no more far right or extreme if you're talking about 73 million people voted for Donald Trump, right?
Okay, at least 73 million.
Right. And so the point being that Michelle Malkin, probably all of them would agree with Michelle Malkin on most issues. So if half the country is more or less agreeing with Michelle Malkin, then how is she extreme and far right? Well, I talked before about how the Southern Poverty Law Center does what they do. And one of the things that they do is what I call the ransom note method. That what they do is they take a phrase from here and a couple of sentences from there, and that, in other words, that they will cut and paste together from a vast body of work.
There's a perfect example of that that people use from the New Testament. And Judas went and hanged himself. And then there's another verse that says, go thou and do likewise.
Right. Okay. So in other words, you cut and paste from their arguments. and you reassemble it like a kidnapper cutting out magazine articles to create words and from magazine articles to create a ransom note. And so this is what's been called the ransom note. Now, I could tell you the name of the friend who first used this phrase, but I don't want to give away secrets of the thought criminal cartel to which I belong. But you know, the thing is that I can, in my cell phone, okay, I can speed dial some pretty extreme people, okay, because one of the things I know about politics is that most of the politics is a football game played between the 40-yard lines, okay? You very seldom get anything, any radical changes out of politics. It's two teams battling it out near the center of the field. And so if you want to know which direction we're going, okay, and what the future holds in politics, you better go look around the fringes, right? Uh-huh. Okay, so that Antifa, right? If you want to know where the Democrat Party is going, mm-hmm. go look at these Antifa radicals, Black Bloc, as they're sometimes, these anarchists and the arsonists and the looters, okay? Mm-hmm. This fringe, AOC, another example. Go to the most extreme fringe and see what they're talking about. Well, it was Michael Brendan Doherty who pointed out that the guy who basically mapped out what Donald Trump did, okay, that in other words, Donald Trump's victory, the guy who figured that out was Sam Francis. Now, I actually knew Sam Francis back in the day. He lost his job at the Washington Times, where he was a very popular and award-winning columnist and editor. He lost his job because he was accused of guilt by association with people like Jared Taylor and so forth. Go ahead.
Well, but I mean, if you look, pay attention to AOC, the mm-hmm. same reason that Democrats should have ought to paid attention to Barry Goldwater. Mm-hmm. Barry right. Goldwater in 64, Ronald Reagan in 1980.
Right.
And AOC stirring things up now. Watch out that what happens if that takes hold among the Democrats. Meanwhile, we've got 60 some odd days left before the inauguration day. And I get a day off on inauguration day because I work for do consulting work for the federal government. But between now and then, there's some things that Donald Trump needs to do, whether he's going to take the oath of office on that day or not. He needs to close out this first term. And the first thing I recommend that he should do is that he should work closely with McConnell and make sure there isn't a single vacancy in the federal judiciary left. And second, he should direct everybody who is at all the federal agencies to finish up rulemaking, whether it's eliminating rules or improving on them, but to make sure that all those rules get upgraded as much as we can. And third, he should, by an executive order, declassify and publish all information and documents held by any federal agency that relate to the Crossfire Hurricane investigation, the Mueller investigation, or Hunter Biden's laptop. And then finally, I think he should pardon Joe Biden for any acts that Joe Biden did while he was vice president. Not anything before he was vice president or anything he did after he was vice president. First of all, the federal statute of limitations is about to run out on anything that Biden did when he was vice president. And secondly, there's probably enough stuff that's happened since, well, never mind. but I'll just leave it at that. But meanwhile, you know what, Stacy? Crazy people are dangerous.
Yes, yes, yes. And usually... The Crazy People Are Dangerous file is reserved for someone who has committed criminal acts. But this week, we're talking about Tommy Lahren. Lahren? How's that pronounced? I think it's Tommy Lahren. She's a Fox News personality. And if you know her, she's a 28-year-old blonde who is not bad to look at.
Yeah, this one passes on Rule 5.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyways, I did a post this week called What's Wrong with Tommy Lahren? And it had to do with something that columnist Suzanne Vanker called my attention to, that a couple of months ago, Tommy Lahren posted a video on Facebook denouncing men quite generally. And I'm going to quote here from Vanker's column. In her Facebook screed, Lahren railed against today's men whom she claimed are trash and then proceeded to offer said men advice on how to land, quote, talented, skilled, ambitious women who have something going on. And she said, Lahren said, if all these women, including myself, are having issues, then I have to think it might not be us. It might be you. It might be men. Don't call us difficult because we're not. We're not good enough. We are too enough, and you can't handle it. And this kind of thing, coming from someone who is supposed to be a conservative, right? And just doing this anti-male rant.
Look.
It sounds like she was disappointed in love to me.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, look, women in general, when you are disappointed in love, and it does happen, you sometimes find yourself stomping around and muttering about how mad you are at men in general. You get over it. But in this day and age, you post a rant on Facebook, and the next thing you know, the internet is forever, and you have people wondering what's wrong with you.
Well, I've seen really talented, beautiful women destroy their lives because they get into this cycle and they get into being reinforced by other women who've got similar problems.
Yeah, you get a hen party going on, but the point is that guys can do this too.
Oh yeah.
Let me quote a famous poet named Jay-Z. He said, "If you're having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one." Okay. But anyways, I hear some other musical accompaniment in the background that ain't Jay-Z. And so we are approaching the end of the other podcast.
We've got about a minute.
We will be back 7 p.m. next Saturday night, folks.
Okay, we'll see you next week. Thanks for joining us, Diana.
Anytime. Bye-bye. Keep going down.